Jaya Jaya Shri Chaitanya Jaya Nityananda Advaita Chandra Jaya Gaura Bhakta Vrinda
Jaya Advaita Chandra Jaya Gaura Bhakta Vrinda
Yeka Leka Rena Jagannatha Darshana
Yeka Leka Rena Jagannatha Darshana
Mane Bhave Kurukshetra Panachi Milana
Mane Bhave Kurukshetra Panachi Milana
Yeka Leka Rena Jagannatha Darshana
Yeka Leka Rena Jagannatha
Mane bhave purushetra panachi milana
Mane bhave purushetra panachi milana
Yeka leka rena jagannatha darshana
Yeka leka rena jagannatha darshana
Mane bhave purushetra panachi milana
Mane bhave purushetra panachi milana
Yeka leka rena jagannatha darshana
Yeka leka rena jagannatha
Mane bhave kurukshetra panachi milana
Mane bhave kurukshetra panachi milana
Lekale karena jagannatha darshana
Lekale karena jagannatha darshana
Mane bhave kurukshetra panachi milana
Mane bhave kurukshetra panachi milana
Lekale karena jagannatha darshana
Lekale karena jagannatha darshana Mane bhave kurukshetra panachi milana
Ladies?
Yeka leka rena jagannatha darshana
Mane
bhave kurukshetra panachi milana Yeka leka rena jagannatha darshana
Mane bhave kurukshetra panachi milana
Okay, I didn't say, but reading from Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita, Madhya Lila, chapter 1, verse 53. Yeka le. At those times.
At those times.
Karena.
Karena.
Okay. Yeah, just low the electric like, rather than sort of yeah, great, thanks. Karena
does
Jagannath
Lord Jagannath
Darshana
visiting
Mane
within the mind
Bhave
thinks
Kurukshetra.
Kurukshetra.
On the field of Kurukshetra.
On the field of Kurukshetra.
Panachi.
Panachi.
I have gotten.
I have gotten.
Milana.
Milana.
Meeting.
Meeting.
Translation. At those times, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu would visit Lord Jagannath. Then his feelings exactly corresponded to those of the gopis when they saw Krishna at Kurukshetra after long separation. Krishna had come to Kurukshetra with his brother and sister to visit. Please repeat. At those times, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, would visit Lord Jagannath.
Then his feelings
exactly corresponded, to those of the gopis, when they saw Krishna. At Kurukshetra, after long separation. Krishna had come to Kurukshetra, with his brother and sister, to visit. Purport by his divine grace, Srila Prabhupada. When Krishna was performing yajna sacrifice at Kurukshetra, he invited all the inhabitants of Vrindavan to come see him. Lord Chaitanya's heart was always filled with separation from Krishna, but as soon as he had the opportunity to visit the Jagannath temple, he became fully absorbed in the thoughts of the gopis who came to see Krishna at Kurukshetra. Translation again. At those times, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu would visit Lord Jagannath. Then his feelings exactly corresponded to those of the gopis when they saw Krishna at Kurukshetra after long separation. Krishna had come to Kurukshetra with his brother and sister to visit. Om Majanatamrandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshu Unlitamina Tasmai Sri Gurve Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Stapitamina Bhutale Swaya Rupa Kramayam Dadati Swapadamatikam Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadha Shivasadi Gaur Bhaktivinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare 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 Krishna. Okay. When I was reading the verse, these subject matters are you know, so high, so lofty, and but it reminded me of a reference that I'd read recently, how all those devotees who participate in Lord Chaitanya's Sankirtan movement are actually directly part of this lila of separation, these ecstatic symptoms of being separated, Krishna being separated from Radha, and then Radha, and then being in union again, that we're directly participating in those pastimes by being part of Lord Chaitanya's Sankirtan movement. So they're simultaneously very lofty subject matters, but they're not If we approach them with the right mood, then they're not out of bounds. It's not that they're actually out of bounds like that. So, of course, approaching them in the right mood is super duper important. We can't emphasize that strongly enough, how to approach these subjects in the right mood. And of course, we do it in a humble mood, a mood of service, a mood of understanding our true position vis-a-vis Krishna and his devotees. I think a little earlier in this chapter, the later pastimes of Lord Chaitanya, particularly the six Goswamis, and then the six Goswamis, particularly Rupa Sanatan and Jiva Goswami, are being glorified for the literature that they've given us, because ultimately all of this knowledge, if you like, of these subject matters has been translated by the Goswamis, and then different devotees have distilled it further. I think that in this chapter they're talking about the Satsang Dharma and the Gopala Champu dealing with all these different subject matters of Krishna's pastimes. I think 60 supplications in all. And then the Satsang Dharma, which has three parts, has the Tapasang Dharma, which is establishing that the Srimad Bhagavatam is the topmost scripture. Shastra on the Supreme Personality of Godhead. There is no other scripture available, or it just doesn't exist, that has more information and describes the Tattva better than the Srimad Bhagavatam. And then there's the Bhagavat Sandarbha, which is explaining the difference between the localized Paramatma and also the difference between localized Paramatma and the impersonal Brahman. And it also discusses Sudasattva and how we have to get to the level of Sudasattva before we can really practice Krishna consciousness properly and really enter into the higher realms. Because the mode of goodness, which is obviously better than passion and ignorance, and Prabhupada often quoted the poet Cowper. We have some streets in Dublin called Cowper Road and Cowper Downs and Cowper Avenue in Rathmines, Rathgar. Just talking to a fellow Dopey. what was I saying? Cowper, yeah. That man built the city and God built the country. So the city is infused with passion and ignorance. And people, you know, find it very difficult not to be totally dictated to by those lower modes of nature, which all of you wonderful Vaishnavas are only too familiar with when you're walking from your apartments, particularly the Frith Street apartment, to Mangalarti every day, when you see passion and ignorance very liberally on show. And then the country is built by God, so it's very much mode of goodness. But the mode of goodness on its own is always prone to and is contaminated. Jai. But the mode of goodness of its own is always prone to being affected by the mode of ignorance and the mode of passion. So to really practice Krishna consciousness properly, we have to enter the realm of Sudasattva. And so the Bhagavad Sandarbha describes that in an elaborate way. And then the last one is the Paramatma Sandarbha, which is discussing and explaining how the Supersoul enters into every living entity and ultimately every atom. Like, and this is where it helps us. That's why it's amazing, you know. Although the Goswamis, etc., are discussing these really elevated subject matters, by first discussing these topics, and if we study these topics, it really, really helps us to enter the other subject matter in the right mood, because we get into really fantastic areas, and you know, if we're understanding, and understanding is one thing, but even accepting this information, it really puts us in the right frame of mind, because we become completely humbled by seeing how actually insignificant we are in relation to what's going on in Krishna's creation. You know, it's fantastic. In the Bhagavatam, the third canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, Brahma's prayers for creative energy, it's explaining how, because Lord Brahma, let me get it right now, there are 4,320,000,000 of our years in 12 hours of Lord Brahma's day. 12 hours. It's 4,320,000,000 years. Just sort of let them figures sink in, you know. That represents 12 hours of Lord Brahma's existence. 4 billion. I mean, up to 200 years ago, the scientists used to say that the Earth is only 6,000 years old. That's when creation started. Then they started finding some fossils and whatever that... Anyway, this is my pet subject, and I don't want to deviate too much, but I have to just make a little quick sit in front of you and say, now we understand the Earth to be, you know, what was the thing, I think it was here last time when I was giving this example, that they found something not called a black hole, something additional to a black hole, and they say that if you travel at the speed of light for, how long was it, speed of light for 164,000 years or something like that, you won't come to the end of this thing that is not a black hole, but I can't remember what it's called, so it's like a black hole. So from 200 years ago telling us that the Earth is only 6,000 years old, now we can travel at speed of light. Speed of light is, I think, 84,000?
Yeah.
Thank you very much. But you don't know the miles, right? Because you're French. Kilometers. Oh, Spanish. Sorry. But still, you won't know the miles, because it's only us English and Irish that know the miles. So thank you very much. So 300,000 kilometers
per second.
So I think the figure was 164,000 years. You can travel at the speed of light, and you won't come to the end of. So 164,000 years, traveling 300,000 kilometers a second. You know, just getting these kind of, and they had the neck to sit in front of us with a straight face and present these facts, and then change them. And every time they find something that doesn't fit in, they'll just change it. It's just incredible. But anyway, that was a deviation. I'm sorry about that. I had to say that. Lord Brahma, his whole life then, I don't know the exact figure, but I think it's 311 trillion years, right? Isn't that the figure? 311 trillion. So Lord Brahma's life in our years is 311 trillion years. If we just, you know, try to take that on board, you know, and don't think of it as some kind of fantasy or some kind of, you know, whatever. You know, this other verse that I quote quite often from the Bhagavad Gita, Etam Bhutam Yogam Chaam Mayati Tattvataha, Krishna says directly, 10:7, says, what does he say now? I'm going to get it exactly right. He says that if you are convinced of this opulence and mystic power of mine, if you're convinced of it, then you will engage in unalloyed devotional service. Of this there is no doubt. So, you know, let's not think of these things as some kind of fantasy or whatever, have doubts about them, let's understand it. Lord Brahma is living for 311 trillion of our years. But Lord Brahma, whole life, Lord Brahma's whole life is but one breath of Mahavishnu. Just one breath. Mahavishnu breathes, that's 311 trillion of our years. One breath. And Mahavishnu is but a partial expansion of Krishna. So, you know, when we really try to absorb those concepts and those factual statistics, which is what they are, then, you know, how can we take Lord Chaitanya's pastimes and Krishna's pastimes in a cheap way? We won't. We will see how, just basically, we'll see how incredibly fortunate we are that by being here, living in this temple, by going out on Harinam, going out on Sankirtan, looking after the deity, cooking in the restaurant, you know, talking with guests, etc., we are actually part of this lila of separation and union. It's viranhantaka is the union and separation. It is an ecstatic kind of pastimes that go on between Radha and Krishna. Yeah, so that's the situation. And then in relation to Lord Brahma, when for the prayers of creative energy, why he recited those prayers was because when he was born, because as we know, Mahavishnu creates the whole Mahatattva, or the whole material creation, Mahavishnu creates like that. And then Garbhadakshaya Vishnu goes into each and every universe like that, of the Mahatattva, for the creation to take place. And then Lord Brahma is born from the navel of Garbhadakshaya Vishnu, and then the idea is that he creates and populates and gets everything going in each individual universe. So when he was born of Garbhadakshaya Vishnu, and he came out of the lotus stem, and he came out, and he looked in all four directions to see what was all around him, and actually that's why he has four heads, because he looked in the four directions. But then, you know, he was just totally bewildered. He hadn't a clue what to do, or where he was, or what was going on. He didn't know. So, like, going back to the scientist example, like all good scientists, you know, what they do is they try to find out, trace things back, like that. They trace things back. So Lord Brahma, he went back into the lotus and back down the stem of the lotus and back as far as he could go. But that brought him nothing either. He was also still none the wiser as to what to do and where he should be, etc. So after he had done that, he came back out, and that's when he started praying for guidance. He could understand there was somebody or something superior to him, and therefore he wanted to ask for guidance and direction, you know, from that person. And that's when he started his prayers for creative energy, and then Krishna gave him the inspiration to create. So that's Lord Brahma, 311 trillion of our years. And you can see why there might just be a possibility, and why we chant every morning, every morning we recite, sorry, as opposed to chant, we recite the second offense against the holy name, that we should not consider demigods like Brahma, Panicharitamrita, Yastu Narayanam Devam, Brahma Rudradi Devahai, Samat Evena Vikshita, Sampasandi Bhavet Juvam, just about got it. And that verse is telling us that Yastu Narayanam Devam, that Narayan, the name Narayan, is superior to Brahma Rudradi Shiva Brahma. And then the last line, Sampasandi Bhavet Juvam, Sampasandi is meaning you're a great offender. A great offender to consider Brahma, Shiva, and these demigods on the same level as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But you can see why people might actually fall into that trap, because if somebody is living for 311 trillion of our years, then they're pretty much in a superior position to us. Now, of course, the flip side of that, which is also very, very important, Vaishnavanam Yata Sambhu, that Lord Shiva is the greatest of devotees, is that there's a very clear distinction between thinking somebody to be the same as Krishna and equal to Krishna, because I know when I grew up in Krishna consciousness, this kind of mood was there to some degree, that it's like, you know, we'll all have a their open season for having demigods, who are they, what are they. So it's very, very important to understand that. No, we offer all respects to these great devotees and superior personalities, but the fact of the matter still is that they are not nearly, just as we can be in awe, we can be in great awe of the fact that Lord Brahma lives 311 trillion of our years, but Lord Brahma is just a breath of Mahavishnu. So how great then is Mahavishnu? And Mahavishnu is just a partial expansion of Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So here again, at those times, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu would visit Lord Jagannath. Then his feelings exactly corresponded to those of the gopis when they saw Krishna at Kurukshetra after long separation. Krishna had come to Kurukshetra with his brother and sister. So again, going back to the Goswamis, there's one pastime that is given to us by the Goswamis, and it's described as being the first Ratha Yatra, and it's directly relating to this verse and purport that we're discussing today. When Krishna was in Dwarka, and he was separated from Radharani and the gopis, and Mother Yashoda and Nanda Maharaj, who were all in Vrindavan. But one of the symptoms of these feelings of separation, and they're so intense and they're so strong, these feelings of separation, that Krishna would, go in and out of consciousness and faint, etc. So there's this story where he's in Dwarka and he faints like that. And Narada Muni and Uddhava are the first devotees to find him. And then they're discussing what they should do. It's kind of funny how it's written, because they're discussing what they should do to bring Krishna back to consciousness, which is interesting. Yeah. So they're discussing like that. And they decide on the strategy that they come up with. Is that Narada Muni will start chanting the glories of Rajabhumi to Krishna, and as soon as Krishna hears the glories of Rajabhumi being chanted, then he's immediately going to wake up. So Narada Muni gets out his veena and he's just about to start, and Balaram arrives, and then Balaram says, well, hang on a second. Wait a minute. If you chant the glories of Vrindavan, then Lord Krishna is going to immediately wake up. And what's he going to do? He's going to want to immediately be in and go to Vrindavan. So they said, that's a problem. Yeah, we better not do that. So then they decided to get Daruka, Krishna's chariot driver, to have his chariot ready, so when Krishna wakes up, they can immediately just put Krishna onto the chariot and bring him to Vrindavan. So then they're about to start again, and then Balaram says, well, wait a second. If you do that, then when Krishna's approaching Vrindavan, he's going to hear the piteous cries of the inhabitants there, because they're so distressed from such a long separation from Krishna. And when he hears those cries, that it will be so distressing to him that it could be the end of Krishna. You know, he won't be able to bear that sad experience. So then, Narada suggests, okay, well, then what Uddhava, your Krishna's messenger, why don't you go to Vrindavan first? You go to head of Krishna, and you just tell the inhabitants of Vrindavan that, Krishna's on his way from Dwarka, so there's no need to be distressed now. You can just prepare for Krishna's visit and get in a really ecstatic mood, positive mood, and prepare for his visit. And then Uddhava says, of course I'll do whatever the Vaishnavas tell me, and you're all my glorious masters, but for me to go to Vrindavan and tell the residents there that Krishna's coming, they're not going to believe me, because Krishna sent me to Vrindavan before to console the residents there. And when I went to Vrindavan to console them, I couldn't console them, because all they wanted was Krishna. And then, he says, it's kind of nice, he says, if someone loses a loved one, if they lose a loved one, then, they'll be very distressed. But you can actually console that person, or at least you can attempt to console them, by just explaining, as it says in Bhagavad Gita, that, for one who takes birth in the material world, death is inevitable. So you can console them like that, and explain to them that the soul doesn't die, etc., and you can give them some consolation. And Prabhupada gives that nice example of of sneha or affection, and our affection is like a liquid. It's like a liquid substance. And then, you know, why are people attached to their bodies? Why do people love their bodies? And you probably heard the example where if you have a boyfriend and a girlfriend, and for some reason, and they're really in love, and for some reason the girl, you know, she dies suddenly like that, it's not that the boyfriend is going to drag her along to the cinema to bring her to the cinema, or drag her along to the disco to bring her to the disco, like you used to see in those Flintstone cartoons where they're dragging someone along over the shoulder like that. They're not going to do that because the person's dead. And what dead means is that soul has left the body. So Prabhupada explains that the reason people are actually in love with their bodies is because the relationship is with the soul, and that's actually what they're loving. They're covered in that sense, and they're thinking they're loving the body, etc. But the real relationship that they're having is with the spirit soul, not with the material body. So the reason that they're loving the body is because they actually love the soul. And then the reason that they love the soul is because they actually love Krishna, because the origin of the soul is Krishna like that. So even people, and it's, you know, it's a nice meditation for us when we're trying to encourage people to take to Krishna consciousness, that the fact that they're loving their bodies is actually, they're covered, but the point is that they're loving their bodies only because they are having a relationship with the soul, and they're actually loving the soul, and ultimately because they love the soul, they're loving Krishna like that. So Uddhava said, I couldn't console them, and just like if a material person loses somebody, you can console them, at least to some degree. But these people, the residents of Vrindavan, they were crying for Krishna. How could I tell them to stop crying for Krishna? That would be an offense to stop. They're calling on Krishna's name like that. So the only consolation I could give them was, I said, okay, I will go to Mathura and I will tell Krishna to come and visit you to give you some consolation. So I went to Mathura, but of course Krishna didn't, I asked him to come, but he's never gone since that. That was some years ago, actually. I think that was over, it was certainly months, but I think it was actually more than a year or something that happened, and Krishna still hasn't gone, and now you want me to go back to Vrindavan to tell them that he's coming from Dwarka? I mean, they're just going to think that I'm a liar, and they're not going to take me seriously at all. That won't work. And then Balaram was requested to do the same, but Balaram has had the same experience, you know, where he's told, you know, Mother Yashoda in particular, that, you know, no, Krishna will come, I'll make sure Krishna will come, and, you know, don't worry, Mother, you know, no need to be distressed. And then I've gone to get Krishna, and Krishna just won't do it, you know. And then he says, you know, Navanita Chora, Krishna has a heart as soft as butter. For somebody who has a heart as soft as butter, how come his heart has become so hard, you know, that he's allowing the residents of Vrindavan to suffer so much? So they were kind of like lost, you know, for their strategy. You know, their brainstorming had come to an end, and they still hadn't got their strategy in place to solve this problem. And just at that point, Subhadra came on the scene, and she said, I have the solution. Which is interesting in our ISKCON brainstorming and meetings, you know, maybe we should be taking some more input from the fair sex, and they can solve some of our problems, maybe. So Subhadra says, I have the problem, the solution, sorry. I have the solution. Freudian slip. I have the solution. And the solution is that I will go to Vrindavan first, because women are very simple and very honest, whereas men, they tend to be crooked, you know, so men don't always get believed, you know, they've always got some other motives going on. But for the residents of Vrindavan, they will listen to me, they will accept what I have to say. So I will simply tell them, yes, I left at the same time as Krishna and Balaram to come here to Vrindavan from Dwarka, but because so many people were wanting to welcome and glorify and pay respects and, you know, offer aarti to Krishna on the way, Krishna's got delayed, but it won't be too long before he's here. So that was the plan. He said, great, let's do that. And then Balaram actually said, okay, well, I can't really let my sister go on her own, then I'll have to accompany her. And that's the thing about the first Ratha Yatra. So Balaram went first, actually, Subhadra directly behind him, and Krishna then came in third place. So that's how the first Ratha Yatra. So then they went to Vrindavan, and they got there. But as soon as Subhadra and Balaram arrived, they just became overwhelmed with the feelings of separation that the residents of Vrindavan were experiencing, and their plan to go and console and tell that Krishna was coming, that actually completely disappeared from their minds, you know, and they didn't actually do it in the end. They just became so overwhelmed with the whole situation. So then Krishna eventually arrived, and at the point that Krishna arrived, well, just before Krishna arrived, Radharani was in a really, what the residents of Vrindavan thought was an incredibly vulnerable situation, and they were even putting cotton wool below her nostrils to see if she was still breathing, and they were completely traumatized, thinking that Radharani was going to leave. So different devotees came to Radharani to plead with her not to go, because they're all part of Krishna's Leela. And if Radharani is the most important part, and if Radharani disappears and it's not there, then Krishna's never going to come to Vrindavan, so all of the residents of Vrindavan will be eternally distraught and distressed. So the different devotees came, and there's one nice story about, in particular, I think, Kutila, who was Radharani's sister-in-law. She was the sister of Abhimanyu. Actually, that's nice as well. Abhimanyu comes, and he's glorifying Radharani, how Krishna's your real husband. You know, it's just because Krishna wanted to enjoy this pastime of Parakya Ras, Paramour Ras, basically. And it is amazing how all these things, and like I say, always talking on these subjects, you have to be, you know, careful. We have to, and that's why at the beginning we're talking about our position vis-a-vis all these wonderful personalities, what to speak of Krishna. And we always have to keep that in the forefront of our minds, you know, because these pastimes are quite incredible. And that Parakya Ras that Krishna wanted to participate in, that, of course, is also reflected in the material world, you know, where, you know, married people, they have affairs and all these different things. There's all, you know, they thrive on that. They like all the excitement that's involved or whatever like that. But, of course, the result of that, you know, 99 times out of 100, is that it ends in disaster. You know, the husband finds out, the wife finds out, the marriage breaks down, the kids are all disturbed and destroyed, and, you know, the divorce courts, and, you know, and there's loads of money involved, and solicitors, and it's just a complete nightmare, you know, because it's the perverted reflection of what's going on in the spiritual world. Whereas here in the spiritual world, Abhimanyu, the husband, the Radharani's actual husband, is coming to her, and he's just in glorification of her. He's in glorification of Krishna. You know, he's the cheated husband. You know, he's the one who's being cheated on. But he's just in ecstasy because he's playing his part in fulfilling Krishna's desire to have this Parakya relationship with Radharani. And not only that, because he knows that it's a pastime, and because he knows that this is Krishna's will and Krishna's desire, he's telling Radharani how, that's why I've never touched you. I could never touch you because I am not your husband. You know, I'm just your shadow husband, your child husband, or you're my shadow wife, like that. So he's coming to her like that and trying to encourage her to revive her in that way. And then Kutila comes, who's Abhimanyu's sister, and she tells this nice story of the time when, again, it's all glorifying Radharani. See, this is the thing about devotional service and devotee relationships. It's all about glorification of devotees and their service to Krishna. Everyone is glorifying all the devotees. We don't glorify ourselves or put ourselves first. We always glorify other devotees and the service that they're doing for Krishna. So she tells the story of when Krishna manifested this pastime of Swara Leela, as in Swara meaning, what's the verse in the Bhagavad Gita? Mayi Sarvani Karmani Sanyasya Chetan Sanyasya. So Swara, in that verse, is referring to feverish mentality, you know, and it relates to gambling, etc. Actually, that's a wonderful verse as well, you know, from the Bhagavad Gita. It so encapsulates the whole mood, actually, of the Bhagavad Gita, you know, that English translation is, if you, therefore, Arjuna, surrender everything unto me. Go ahead.
Surrender all your works unto me, with full knowledge
of
me.
No desire for proprietorship.
No.
Okay.
Desire for profit.
Profit, yeah, and with full and free from lethargy, which is the best one, because it's like, let me just read it again. It's a little bit of a diversion, but you know, it's good. It's such a wonderful verse. Therefore, Arjuna, surrendering all your works unto me, so you surrender everything to this person, everything, you know, Saranagati, everything, all your works unto me. With full knowledge of me, without desire for profit, so there's no motivation for any kind of profit, with no claim to proprietorship, Claiming proprietorship is the single biggest cause of conflict in the material world, the claim for proprietorship, you know, which is basically identification with the body. But specifically when people start claiming things, this land is mine. What's that famous American song? This land is your land, this land is mine. Whatever, you know. It's like, this is our land, you know. And Prabhupada often gives the example of, the example he gives is barking dogs at customs and immigration. You know, they think, this is our country. Now, are we going to let you in? It's like, and you have to have all your papers in order and whatever. Now, of course, in Western society now, in Western countries, they have different codes of conduct and standards that they're meant to live. You'll see, you know, in UK airports, in American airports, you'll see that, you know, you, the customer, so to speak, has rights. Of course, they do also tell you that if you get aggressive or whatever, they'll sort you out. But they do tell you have certain rights, you know. But I remember years ago, I just remember it years ago, I was a teenager and I got one of these tickets around Europe, you know, these train tickets, what they use it or something they're called, and you get these, you can go unlimited travel around the whole of Europe. So as part of that journey, I went from the south of Spain on a train on a little boat ride across to Morocco, you know, the Al Jazeera's in Spain to, I'm not sure where it stopped in Morocco, anyway, doesn't really matter. I just remember getting off and you're going through customs and it's like, first the room that you go through, it was a very, very big room, but it was very dark and dingy. It was also late at night. It was also very warm, you know. The custom guys, they have a uniform on, but like they're 3 or 4 days unshaven, you know. Their ties are all undone and just straggly, you know. The suit is all creased and crumpled and whatever like that, you know. And they just look like gangsters, you know. And you're kind of like, and you're thinking, oh my God, where am I? Like, this is the first official greeting or port of call of this country, and these guys, you look like they're going to take out a gun and shoot you, you know. But anyway, probably give an example of barking dogs, whether they'll let you in or won't let you into their country because of this claim to proprietorship. So with no claims to proprietorship, but then with all of the things, no claim on profit, surrendering everything, no claim over proprietorship, but we're completely free from lethargy. You know, go out there and fight totally enthusiastically, even though you're going to get no land for your troubles, you're going to get no money for your troubles, you know. You go out there and do it. So it's just such a wonderful, wonderful verse, you know. So this shwara, or feverish mentality, so Krishna manifested this lila, shwara lila, which was where he got really ill. He had a huge temperature. And all the devotees went to him and asked him, you know, what can we do to make you better, Krishna? He said, there is only one medicine. You have to find the most sati sadvi, the most chaste woman. And when you find the most chaste woman, she will be able to go to the Yamuna and with a water pot that has hundreds of holes in it, and she'll be able to scoop the water from the Yamuna and come back to me and not spill a drop of that. Not one single drop will spill out of that bowl with 100 holes in it. So Kutila, they all went to Kutila, all the residents of Vrindavan went to Kutila. Kutila had been promoting herself for many, many years as the most chaste lady, a woman of Vrindavan, that she was the most chaste, you know. Not only was she promoting herself as being the most chaste, but she was criticizing Radharani for being the most loose, you know, being a prostitute, because, you know, she was having a parakeer relationship with Krishna when she was married to her brother, like that. So she was criticizing Radharani, and she was glorifying herself as being the most chaste. So they all went to Kutila and they asked her, please go do this, Krishna's really sick, you know, you have to get this sorted. So Kutila went immediately, she went to the Yamuna and she scooped the water out, and by the time she got back to Krishna, not only had she spilt a drop, there wasn't a drop left in the bowl, everything had gone out of the bowl. So Kutila was completely put in her place like that, and she was glorifying Radharani for this and saying, thank you very much, Radharani, for putting me in my place. My ego was completely smashed, so thank you very, very much. And then somehow someone asked, or whatever, Radharani was asked to do it, and Radharani went, she scooped the water, she came back, and not a single drop of the water spilled, you know. So Krishna was completely cured then of his sickness. So anyway, so Krishna eventually arrives in Vrindavan, and he goes to Radharani, and he sees the situation and the state that Radharani is in, and he loses consciousness. You know, and he becomes completely. Well, the first thing the first thing that happens is he is in such ecstasy from being in Vrindavan and seeing Radharani that, you know, all the ecstatic symptoms manifest, and in particular the symptoms of his limbs going into his body. So he directly manifest the form of Lord Jagannath right there in front of Radharani. But then it's too much for him and he collapses. Then one of the gopis, you know, starts telling Radharani that Krishna's here, and that revives Radharani. She also smells the scent of Krishna's the wind coming over Krishna's body, and then Radharani smells that scent and she realizes Krishna, and she wakes up and she revives her, and she's in ecstasy. And then she gets one of the gopis, I think Lalita, to chant Radhe Radhe in Krishna's ear like that, and then Krishna wakes up, you know, and then Radha and Krishna together after this long, long separation. Radha and Krishna together, they spend the night together. Then the cuckoo calls at 4 o'clock in the morning. They get up for Mangal Arati and they have Mangal Arati together. And then there's just this whole and they completely have forgotten that there was ever any concept of separation. That's gone like that. Although Krishna does explain to Radharani that, you know, then there is no such thing as separation. I'm always eternally here with you in Vrindavan. However, in order for this ecstasy and this union to exist eternally, there also has to be the thought the feeling of separation, because it's that feeling of separation that drives the ecstasy that's in the union when we come together like that. But you don't have to worry, because ultimately there is no separation. It's just it's all arranged in order for the union to be ever more and more and more and more sweet and sublime and blissful. And then it's explained how this relationship between Radha and Krishna and Lord Chaitanya and Lord Jagannath, that's the direct relationship between Radha and Krishna and then Lord Chaitanya and Lord Jagannath. Radha Viraha Vidura and Krishna Viraha Vidura. So that's when Lord Chaitanya is in front of Lord Jagannath at the Ratha Yatra. Lord Chaitanya is crying for Krishna in the mood of Radharani being separated from Krishna. And likewise, when Lord Jagannath sees Radharani, he's crying in the mood of separation from Radha. So they're just totally interlinked and interconnected. And that's actually where the reference then is, that because we're part of Lord Chaitanya's movement, we're actually directly participating in these pastimes by expanding and helping with Lord Chaitanya's Sankirtan movement. We're actually part of this. This is, we're not different from it, we're actually part of it. And obviously in terms of manifest Leela, that will come in due course of time, as we advance in Krishna consciousness. Okay, thank you all very much. If anybody has any comment or question, they're very welcome. Is it Jean-Luc or Jean-Marc or Marc-Luc? Jean-Marc, okay. Juan-Marc.
Yeah.
Okay. Juan-Marc, because you're Spanish. Yeah, okay. Well, it's probably not the first thing you try to explain to somebody, you know, you mean like some new person. Well, of course, it's a pastime, and the pastime was to, Krishna wanted, because it is impossible to do, in normal circumstances it's impossible to do, but Krishna wanted to show who the most chaste lady of Vrindavan was, and she was able to do it. But from a devotee's point of view, I mean, it's not so incredible. I mean, you know, Krishna can lift Govardhan Hill. Actually, in one purport, again in the third canto of the Bhagavatam, because there's this pastime where this sage, where Govardhan first descends from the spiritual world, he comes down to a place called Shyamamoli in Western India, and then this sage, I forget the sage's name, he's the one who he's part of. I forget his name anyway. Pulatya? Yeah, I think it's Pulatsaya? Okay, so he comes and he sees Govardhan, and I shouldn't really go into this whole story, but anyway, Govardhan's really beautiful, you know, the rivers and gems and mountains, really, really beautiful. And he thinks, wow, I'd like to have Govardhan back in my ashram over in eastern India. So he asks Govardhan's father, you know, can I take your son? And his father is so respectful to sages that even though he doesn't really want to, he agrees, you know. Anyway, so the sage, I won't get into the whole story because it's too long, but the sage takes Govardhan in his hand, like that. The Govardhan at this stage was 64 miles long and 12 miles wide, I think, you know, so the sage takes Govardhan in his hand. And Prabhupada mentions in the Purport that, you know, this is Krishna can lift. Don't think this sage lifting Govardhan Hill is such a big deal. Krishna can lift millions of Govardhan Hills like that. So, you know, lifting millions of mountains that are 64 miles long and, you know, about 100 kilometers long and, you know, about 24 kilometers wide or something. No, about 20 kilometers wide. You know, lifting millions of those with your little finger is a lot more incredible than creating a situation where water doesn't fall out of a pot. Likewise, creating all these material universes, you know. So, but in terms of explaining it to somebody who is not a devotee, it's probably not the subject matter that you would start with, you know. People have to have a little faith before they can, you know, understand that kind of, those kind of details. Yeah. For people, you know, that we meet on the street, we give them the basic philosophy, you know, not body, spirit, soul. And even that they find hard to accept, you know, people who are really attached to their bodies. Like people, it's interesting. You can give people that information of the soul's eternal, body's temporary, give them different examples of, you know, the Hinusmim, the example of, you know, from birth, death, old age, from birth to youth and whatever, that the soul's the same, the body's changing. And, you know, a lot of them, why should I believe that? How can you prove that you're eternal? How can you prove the soul exists? But on the other side, if someone has a so-called near-death experience, and it's like, you know, in the newspapers, a person, they died, and they had this experience that they went somewhere and they came back, and then people suddenly believe it. You know, it's quite an amazing thing. It's funny, it's the Doubting Thomas kind of syndrome. They have to have either direct experience or they have to have someone who's told them they've had direct experience. Just giving them philosophy alone, for most people, it's difficult for them to accept like that, you know. I know I do that a lot when I go to quite a lot of schools and give presentations. If I ever, I don't bring it up myself, but if I ever ask that question, how can you prove eternality? I'll use examples of near-death experiences that have been documented, and there's many of them now. Where I read one recently in India, I think some girl who, you know, died, she came out and she went back to a village and she knew everybody and everything and all of this kind of stuff, because that pacifies them. They actually then they'll accept that, you know, but they won't accept straight philosophy from Bhagavad Gita, because that's too intangible or that's too, you know, whatever, cerebral. But if they hear a story that someone actually had a near-death experience, then they'll accept it. So yeah, discussing, I mean, even the example of Govardhan having a father, you know, I mean, you know, mountains having fathers, you know, it's like, you know, for devotees, it's kind of like, yeah, it makes perfect sense, you know, what's the problem, you know? But, you know, you go out with a placard on Oxford Street saying, you know, whatever, do you know that mountains have mothers and fathers? It's like, you could find yourself under the care of the, yeah, under the care of the NHS. You were going to add something to it?
I wanted to ask one thing that also was, I've heard, like, that, you know, that's not explained. Somebody said that the reason why it doesn't come out is because someone has such high level of chastity or integrity, the material nature just doesn't work the same for them. Because it's like they have such potency, such maybe the water wouldn't run out of them because they have such high integrity.
It makes perfect sense. No. yeah. Okay, so first off, when we say no claim for proprietorship, it's proprietorship in the context that, you know, this is ours, we own it. And this is my understanding. I mean, many people can give different explanations of this or their understandings of this. The phrase, of course, which is an important point to make, is one of these phrases that's a well-known phrase, and Prabhupada used it. You know, I mean, I really, really don't want to get into controversial subject matter, but you know, when Prabhupada used this reference that a woman's brain was whatever 2/3 the size or whatever of a man's brain, and discussions that then centered around that, Prabhupada was actually, that's not a Shastric quote. That's Prabhupada taking some scientist who he was taught by, or maybe not directly taught by, but in his Scottish colleges was taught. That was just some information in a textbook, you know, and Prabhupada just... And when Prabhupada was asked about it, and Prabhupada said, well, if it's true, it's true. It's not, it's not. But, I mean, you know, it's not that it's a core principle of Krishna consciousness. I was just using it as an example because I'd heard it, whatever. You know what I mean? So it's not Shastra. You know, Prabhupada was making that clear, you know. That he heard the reference and he was just taking it on face value. If it's not true, it's not true. If it is, it is. If it's not, it's not. It's not a, you know. So turning proprietorship, turning sand into gold, is again just the same. Just like Prabhupada quoted Cowper, you know, man built the city, God built the country. You know. So that's the first point I would just to establish like that. So whether it's right or wrong, whatever. But in the context for devotees, how I would understand how that works is that. Take your temple here as an example. Okay, now if you were renting this building, just renting this building, you didn't own it, then your enthusiasm for developing it, particularly putting serious investment into it in terms of money, which you would need for your accommodation, for your temple room, for your restaurant, whatever it may be, so you know you kind of need to do it. But if you are only renting it and you've got a lease that's going to run out in 5 years, you're going to be really reluctant to do it. So proprietorship in that context, not that you're saying, you know, Jainatai is saying, I'm the temple person, this is my building, I own this building. No, you're owning it on behalf of Krishna, and it's better to own it on behalf of Krishna than renting it on behalf of Krishna, because, you know, that then gives you more scope and security to really get into it and develop it. But also, I remember, you know, Sri Ram Maharaj being recorded. Get Maharaj into trouble. But I remember we started this community down in Wicklow in 1988, I think it was, kind of Grihastha community. And we all bought our own houses and then bought a little piece of land in the middle of the, between us, where we built a school and different stuff we did there, Goshala, etc., etc. I remember the first time Rajita visited, or the first time I was talking to him about it. The first question he asked me: did you have you bought? Do you own your houses? Have you bought or whatever? And I said yes. He says, good. He says, this is what we want devotees to do. We want devotees to be buying the houses, you know, and owning property. No, we don't want them to be renting and, you know, flitting and floating and never having security. We want to be established. We want our grihasthas to be established now. So there may be an element then that the grihastha may become a little attached and may become sort of feeling this is mine. But ultimately, I think as long as we're practicing Krishna consciousness, we all know full well that we don't really own it. Ultimately, it's Krishna's, and we want to use it in Krishna's service. And then in terms of, now I'm really getting into detail, but in terms of then legacy, my kind of own mood with it is, kind of similar to Rupa Goswami's guidance, is that, you know, 50%... from a will point of view, will go to ISKCON, and 50% will go to my children, you know, of whatever asset that you have like that. So, you know, that type of proprietorship, I think, is good for the devotee to develop something, and I think it's also good actually for ISKCON, because I tell you, you know, the reason why the Catholic Church, particularly in Catholic countries like España and Irlanda and, you know, France and Italia, the reason why the Catholic Church is so powerful, or was so powerful, is it just owns so much land. And the reason it owns so much land is because they did a particular form of Sankirtan many years ago. Maybe they still do it, I don't know, but they did it. They certainly did it in bygone ages. And that form of Sankirtan was the kind of deathbed Sankirtan, you know, sign over, now you're passing and you'll go to heaven, you know. And that's how they accumulated so much, you know. So... So it's all Krishna's property. So why should Krishna's devotees not have, you know, jurisdiction over it? Better that Krishna's devotees have jurisdiction over Krishna's property than the non-devotees having jurisdiction over Krishna's property. So, is that okay?
Yeah. Actually, while you were telling that,
it
reminded me of something that Small Krishna Bhavs did once. I read another lecture. He had two Bhagavad Gita. And the other one was very cockeyed in the case, they need to check, you know. And you know, it was like, which one belongs to who? And they said, the one that, you know, is in my care and I'm caring for, it's still in very good condition, whereas this one that's just left, it's just Krishna's property.
Good point. Yeah, no, that's a very good point. Yeah. So again, proprietorship, you know, looks after things better. But yeah. Proprietorship. Yeah, it's the same word, but it's different meaning. You know, in the purport of the translation of that verse, it means thinking ownership. I own this, is mine. You know, and the other one, it's like sort of jurisdictional, taken care of. You know, so in that context, proprietorship is good. Sean.
Simply clarify this. Does that mean that proprietorship for a devotee means I'm taking responsibility for this for Krishna?
Yeah.
That's what
I mean. Yeah. Even though legally you can't get Krishna to sign the contract for the house or the whatever it may be, so the devotee will do that. But his mentality is, his state of mind is that, yeah, this is ultimately Krishna's, you know. And I should see it like that, you know. Because it's so silly. That's why, because you laugh when I use that expression, that's why actually, you know, deathbed sankirtan makes so much sense, you know, because no, for the person on their deathbed. I mean, you know, we've got the guideline of 50%, 50%, 25%, 25%. So, but it's actually intriguing, because that's what the Christians or Catholics would have done. They would have intimated that you sign this over, you know, you'll go to heaven, kind of thing. And you know, obviously, if people are giving in charity, they're going to get benefits. So I'm not saying that they wouldn't have got benefit by doing that to the guy. So I'm not dismissing that or saying there's something wrong with that. But how much more benefit people would get if they sign it over to Krishna? You know, you know what I mean? Like if they sign it over, if they have a house, they sign it over to Krishna, and then that money or that facility is used in Lord Chaitanya's Sankirtan movement. It's not a lie to tell them. You know, we won't say you're going to go back to Godhead necessarily, but you know, you will make spiritual benefit, and it's a good thing. It's a good thing for Prabhupada's movement and Lord Chaitanya's Sankirtan movement. But it's a good thing for the person, because what are they going to do with it? Well, they're dying, they're passing away, you know. Anyway, it's just a thing. Yes, Tim.
That point you make about proof is interesting, that you might say the soul exists and, you know, reincarnation is a fact, and somebody says, yeah, well, how can you prove it? But then how can you prove anything? And they're accepting so many things that, you know, I'm going to get paid, I exist, you know, everything around me is actually there, I'm not just imagining it. So, like, that point about proving something that you know 100% sure that is a fact is like an interesting point. Like, I'm thinking that you can't actually prove anything ultimately. Like, can you comment on that?
Well, it's a very good point, and you know, it's really a good subject matter for devotees to discuss on an ongoing basis. You know, because I think it really helps then developing our ways of presenting Krishna consciousness to help convince people, you know, about Krishna consciousness, because it is one of the main stumbling blocks you come up against. Can you prove it? Can you prove God exists? You know, and Prabhupada, you know, we should learn from Prabhupada as well, because you know, there's those examples where Prabhupada would say, okay, let's put Shastra aside. Let's put it all aside. Let's speak on the basis of logic, reason, and argument, you know. Because, and so it's really good for devotees to develop that. But usually I just try to say, okay, you're asking me to prove this. And, you know, the example that we give, that, okay, so you live your life, I live my life. I live my life trying to be a devotee of Krishna and, you know, doing, in inverted commas, all the right things. You live your life, you know, as an atheist, denying the existence of God, doing all, in inverted commas, bad things. So at the time of death, you know, if I'm right, then hey, you're really in a mess, you know. If you're right, then how have I lost? I've had a good, clean life, whatever, no loss anyway. So it's either a win-lose for the devotee against the non-devotee, or it's a sort of a draw or whatever, or what, you know, whatever you want to call it, or a lose-lose, or yeah, whatever. So that's one point, that's one aspect. But then also, because the big thing is, it really does come down to science. It's quite an amazing thing, you know, it's amazing. And the fact of the matter is, they're blind. So many people blindly follow. Like, I gave a presentation a few weeks ago, and one of the questions, kind of smart aleck kid, you know, and his question was, but it's all mathematics. It's just all mathematics, you know. And I said to him, you know, well, you're going to have to do a little better than that. I said, like, you need to get into it. It's all mathematics. You know, what do you mean it's all mathematics? You can't just say, it's all mathematics. And you know, oh, yeah, it's all mathematics. Okay. Yeah, you've got to put some, you know, some batter on the pakora, so to speak, as opposed to pushing the bar. So you know, we have to take them on. And Prabhupada did it. Prabhupada was so proud of Hansa Dutta and that whole exchange of the back of life comes from life, you know, because they were taking on the scientists like that. But and now we have Dhruta Karmaguru in his books, and he's just a fallacy. They change every time one of two things. They find something that doesn't fit in, they change their story, or they find something that really doesn't fit in and they hide it, you know, they don't tell anybody about it. So, you know, we take them on. Like, for instance, the classic thing is they all think we've gone to the moon, you know. Now, that's just verbatim. You know, there's nobody out practically. There are some groups of people, movements, who think we didn't go to the moon. We know that. But, you know, we're talking 95% of the people on this planet, you know, we have been to the moon like that. So this came up in this conversation, and I said, how do you know that they've been to the moon? So I saw it on the telly. Well, have you seen Lord of the Rings? You know? And he says, yeah. I says, do you believe all that happened? You know, I couldn't give an example, which was a pity, but anyway, he took the point, you know, in the class. More importantly, actually, the audience take the point. I said, so how do you know they went? Okay, you saw it on the telly, it was in the newspapers. Okay, but how do you know that they went to that thing that we see in the sky? Now? How do you know? Unless you were there, you personally went there. How do you know? How do you know it's not a big conspiracy? I'm not saying it is, but how do you know it isn't? You know? So you're accepting so many things blindly. Like that, so that's one, and then there's another angle that I had in my mind there, and it slipped. Of course, imperfect senses, you know, we can't see through walls, you know, we can't hear more than whatever 50 meters, etc. But it doesn't mean things aren't going on, things aren't happening. I had another one that's gone, pity. But definitely take them on, you know, because they're on such shaky ground, and particularly, I mean, it's different if you're debating with some, you know, really expert scientist or philosopher, but these aren't, you know, and they're just basically the thing that they're accusing you of or us of having blind faith. They're doing exactly the same thing themselves. They're just blind faith, you know.
It seems like we have to have some faith, otherwise it's like you can't go forward, you can't accept anything otherwise.
Exactly. They won't switch on the television. Why do they buy a newspaper? Why do they go into a shop and buy a newspaper? Because they know when they buy that newspaper, or they have faith when they buy that newspaper, that it's going to give them the information that they're looking for, albeit very mundane information. But, you know, that's the point. You know, everything we do on the basis of faith. Yeah, why does someone go to work? You know, because they know, or they have the faith that they'll get the paid at the end of the week. Because sometimes they don't. The company could go bust in the middle of the week and they wouldn't get paid. So they're putting faith into the fact that this is going to happen like that. You know, or getting on airplanes. Hey, you know. Biggest leap of faith you can take, practically, well, maybe not the biggest leap of faith, but, you know, pretty substantial leap of faith, you know, getting on this, you know, metal tube of toothpaste with two things sticking outside, you know, and I'm trusting it's going to get me from, like, here, you know, to over to there and whatever. It's like, so much. Everyone is having faith, without a shadow of a doubt, you know, and otherwise, as you say, you couldn't do anything. You would just cease to exist, because don't believe anything with faith in anything. So what's it better to believing? I mean, that was Prabhupada's standard argument. So you accept your authority, fine. You accept your authority who has limited senses, you know, imperfect senses, who's a sense enjoyer, you know, etc., who has told us so many times they've made so many mistakes, you know. Krishna doesn't tell us, he makes mistakes. Oh, God, that one wrong. Hey, see that? You see that verse 16, chapter 16, verse 10? You scrub that one out, actually, that's wrong. You know, it doesn't happen, you know. But the scientists, the doctors, hey, you know, 6 months ago, they all came out, all the doctors and all the medical people, all have unified together to confirm, absolutely, with no dissenting voices, to confirm that the single biggest cause of cancer in humans is the eating of red meat and processed meat. Biggest cause of cancer. They're all in agreement. With the possible exception of smoking, because that's a huge one as well. But, you know, particularly intestinal cancer, colon cancer, stomach cancer, all those kind of cancers. Biggest cause, eating red meat and processed meat. And you know another interesting thing? Because, again, you know, a lot of devotees are into this now, and they'll argue this point. And And if you read the descriptions in Krishna book of what they eat and foods and the mode of goodness, etc., an even bigger cause of cancer is not just red meat and processed meat, but it's stuff that gets overcooked. They actually advise people barbecues are really, really bad for you. You know, eating charred, burnt food, you know, like they eat on these sausages, I mean, it's all burnt or whatever like that, you know. I mean, you know, a little bit for us, sometimes we overdo our chapatis and they I must say, I've always preferred really soft chapatis. But anyways, so, but the point is, Bhagavatam is telling us this eternally. You know, we shouldn't be eating meat for all sorts of reasons, including health reasons. Right, we know that. So they're working on a cure for cancer. The main ingredient that they're using as the basis for this cure for cancer is turmeric. You know, it's like, hey, you know. And just that example that I gave actually about accepting things like near-death experiences because they feel that's more tangible or whatever. So I've been trying to get my sister to be a vegetarian for like since I became a devotee, you know. All my family, but there's a particularly one sister that I've been sort of trying to work on, you know, and I haven't been successful 27 years. I still can't do it. Anyways, so she rings me up, and that because you know it was on BBC, it was on Sky, it was on all the news media and whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. So she says, "Oh, boy, I just got this, you know, this is like biggest cause of cancer." You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's amazing, you know. It's an amazing thing.
Yeah.
This is an amazing thing. I told that story, I'll just tell it quickly. You know, just coming over here yesterday on the airplane, the woman beside me, just as we were taking off, she took out a bag of sweets and she popped a sweet in my mouth. She offered me one. And they were wine gums. Most of us UK personalities know what wine gums are. I was just when I was saying it yesterday, some devotees have never heard of wine gums. But most of us know what wine gums are, right? So I said, "No, it's okay." I didn't say why. I just said, and I said to her after I took off, let it settle down a little bit, and then I said to her, "You know, I said it's kind of coincidental that you've offered me a wine gum." I said because wine gums were my favorite sweets. I loved wine gums, you know, because they weren't too sweet. They're not like really sweet things, but they were nice and chewy and they were flavorful. I said, I loved wine gums. They were my favorite sweets. So it's just kind of coincidental that you're offering me one and I'm refusing. I said, the reason that I'm refusing is that I said, 27 years ago, I became a vegetarian. I said, and you know the funny thing is? I said, giving up meat and giving up fish and giving up eggs and things like that, that was really easy. I didn't miss them at all. I said, but giving up wine gums, that was a real tough one, you know, because I really loved those wine gums. I said, but unfortunately, they've got the lining of cow's stomachs in them, that's the jelly. That's what makes them all chewy. I said, so that's why I've given up wine gums. And she said to me, boy, she said, I've been thinking about becoming a vegetarian. And I says, go for it. It's really, really easy. She says, no, but like you, I really love wine gums. I says, well, listen. I said, listen, we'll make a deal. I said, keep on eating the wine gums, but actually give up the meat and the fish and the eggs. Give up those three things. Keep eating your wine gums, and then after a year you can review it and see what you think, you know. I mean, that was just kind of interesting. Okay, it's nearly 9 o'clock, Janataibu, so what I'll probably do is, because Janataibu would ask me, because you do it every Sunday, you do reference to this book. I think you just started. Oh, I see, I'm an organizer. Okay. So this is the introductory course in Vaishnava Studies handbook, Vaishnava Culture. It's been put together by the Vaishnava Training and Education team at Bhaktivedanta Manor. And I looked at it briefly, and, you know, it looks like a very nice book. You know, you learn a lot of stuff from it. So Janataibu asked me to start off on this subject, relating to devotees with due respect. So basically being appreciative of devotees and avoiding, you know, when we say relating to devotees with due respect, you know, the single biggest thing that we can do in that regard, really, is to avoid offending devotees, you know, to avoid Vaishnava Aparad, which, you know, is taken so, so seriously by Shastra and by all our great devotees. Aparad, literally meaning, you know, Aparadha, against Radha, and then another interpretation of that is that if you perform Aparad, you actually remove yourself from devotional service. You can't actually perform devotional service if you're committing offenses to devotees. So because we're kind of up for time, when Jainatai mentioned it to me, it just so happened that recently I'd read two quotes on the subject, and I just thought they were really powerful quotes. I hadn't actually read this. One of them definitely I hadn't heard before. I don't know, maybe some of you have heard this, but just I've probably heard it, but you know, forgotten it or whatever. But this is Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu speaking. Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu himself, which is amazing. Those who worship me directly but neglect my devotees are in illusion and cause me pain. Their offerings feel like a shower of burning cinders on my body. You know, so not only are you serving, you're thinking you're serving Lord Chaitanya, not only is it not having a positive effect, not only is it not neutral, the service you're offering, Lord Chaitanya is saying, is that it feels like a shower of burning cinders on my body. I presume none of us have had a shower of burning cinders, but we can all well imagine what it would feel like having a shower of burning cinders on one's body. He who criticizes and offends my devotees will be destroyed by chanting my name. Powerful, powerful. Give up criticizing Vaishnavas and take shelter of my name. And then here's another one. Even if one worships the Lord for millions of lifetimes, if he continues to offend devotees, it will be impossible to gain the Lord's mercy. So they were the quotes I just thought were relevant. I mean, there's more to this, but it's kind of gone nine, so to go through it, I don't know, there's a lot. It's just the headings relating to devotees with due respect, important points about etiquette, glories of devotees, and then there's different quotes from Shastra in relation to etiquette, etc. I'll just read this one here, because this is just a few points. Some points to be followed in relation to etiquette. Properly offer obeisances and respect. Then in relation to speech, never use unpleasant words. Never lie. Don't speak badly of others. We shouldn't look at faults. We should try to see the good qualities of others. Don't laugh too loudly. That's interesting. I need to take heed of that one. Don't tease people who are dumb, mad, in need, ugly, lame, or fallen. should we tease anybody? It sounds like, okay, I'll find someone today who's not dumb, not mad, not in need, isn't particularly ugly, isn't lame, and isn't particularly fallen, and then I'll tease them. I'll give them a good tease. Okay. Don't reprimand anyone except your own children or students. Don't blow your own trumpet, like Kutila was saying that she was the most chaste lady of Vrindavan. Then association. Don't develop friendship with people who are envious, fallen, mad, debauched, liars, unscrupulous, have illicit connection with women, or with unchaste women. What's that verse? Anukulyasya sankalpa pratikulasya vajana. That we should accept everything as favorable and give up everything that's unfavorable for Krishna consciousness. They're all unfavorable things. If someone insults you, leave the place quietly. We should always try to give service to the Vaishnavas. Worshipping Krishna must be accompanied by service to his devotees. Service to devotees is higher than service to Vishnu. So just in case we misinterpret that, it's not that when we see a devotee come, we say, hey, we've got some service for you to do, you can go out and clean the floor, and if you have to, you've done that, if you can come back. No, it's like serving the devotee, going and offering service to the devotee. Well, it depends on the role you play, of course, you know. But, yeah. Anyway, I'm sure I've told that story before. I know what I'm telling you. I'm sure I've told never take sides in a dispute between devotees. We are servants, therefore we address each other as Prabhu, Master. Everyone has something better than you. You can always learn something from everyone. If you engage your godbrothers as your servants, you will fall down. By offering obeisances, one can get free from sinful reactions. One is purified and can attain the lotus feet of Shihari. The godbrothers of the Guru should be respected just as the Guru himself. Devotee always looks for reasons to give respect to others. Okay, so that was just some basic points. But I'm sure that you can discuss further at another date. Okay, so thank you all very much. Shri Chaitanya Charitamrita ki. Srila Prabhupada ki.